Hi. This week, for our 30th episode, I talk with Deb Chatra about technology, engineering, education of future generations, and also some of the ways she gets her work done. It's quite a long episode, so I'll get straight into it.
I'm kind of interested how you encompass all of these different varied things, or maybe you're not kind of compressing it down to a single thing. Maybe you're just happy with complexity, or...
So I mean, first of all, I'm extremely fortunate in that my day job lets me sort of explore lots of different things. And it's kind of funny because a lot of the stuff that I talk about at Meta Foundry is very much tangential to what I spend most of my days doing, right? So at heart, I'm an engineering professor. I teach at a small undergraduate college, so it means I only teach undergraduate students. We don't have grad students. And I came to Olin College because it's a new college. Our first class graduated in 2006. And I came here to be part of building the college, and the college has a mission to teach engineering differently, but also to work with other institutions to help them teach engineering differently. So the space that I really live in is educating kind of the next generation of engineers. So unsurprisingly, that means that I have a really deep interest in technology and technology in the world, and a very deep interest in how technologists see and shape that world. So fortunately, that's an incredibly broad remit, right? So particularly since part of the whole sort of teaching engineering differently is moving away from the sort of engineering science model, in terms of sort of content where you sort of do all the math and science first and then you start to design things, to a model that's much more around people and context. And so design is more sort of strongly rooted in that. And so basically thinking about not engineering as sort of the sort of separate thing that you do in your lab or your room in isolation, but basically understanding that it's very strongly grounded in the world around you. So, and you know, the phrase that we use inside Olin is contextual awareness, right? The sort of idea of what the larger the larger work that you're doing in. And it's really moving away from this idea of engineers sort of working, doing kind of what they're sort of told to do and designing a widget and not really thinking about the context in which they're doing that. Whether it's, I mean, even very simply the sort of economic context, but also starting to think about things like the broader social context. So
you wrote this article, I forget exactly when it was, in The Atlantic about why I'm not a maker, which seemed to be getting at that point, right?
Yeah, so that was sort of very specifically in reaction to tech culture in particular really prioritizes making things over other things, over any other kind of work. And that particular piece actually started because a friend of mine, and I've seen this in other friends, but my friends were being very defensive about doing any work that wasn't sort of writing and shipping code or building things. I happen to think that that kind of work is really important. But that really, and particularly that's important because, for two reasons. One, it's important in its own right, right? That caregiving and education and, you know, work with other people is important and generally underappreciated. But the other thing, of course, is that a lot of that work is really necessary to do a good job with the making and shipping things. And then the other side of it, of course, is that I see, so there's that sort of tech culture, like, you know, making things, real artists ship, you know, kind of focus on, it only counts if you're actually making something. And I don't think it was intended to do this. I don't think it was intended to exclude people to do other things. I think it was really just supposed to, like, you know, encourage people to, like, make stuff and get stuff out there and iterate. But the effect that it had was that it does. And part of that is because it wasn't happening in isolation, right? It's happening against a many thousand year history of who got to make things and send them out in the world and who was actually doing the caregiving. So it was really kind of easy to sort of reify those norms when you do this and kind of forget that there's other kinds of people. So there's sort of two other pieces to that. Adam Jane of Superflux wrote a really great piece recently in the last couple of weeks about making as caring, which she talks about the work that specifically, like, she but also her partner John Arden do. And that really is sort of making it sort of maintenance and the sort of jagad, like making use of what you have and being deeply rooted in the communities and using the resources that are available. That I think is a really interesting sort of counterpoint to the piece that I wrote. That making isn't just about sort of building these sort of things de novo, but it is possible to do making that is deeply rooted in the community that you're in. And of course, that type of making has been happening all along, right? So it's just not the kind of making that people sort of think or talk about when they talk about making. That kind of making that's really kind of rooted in caregiving. And then the other sort of counterpoint from an education point of view. So Olin is a place that's really about hands-on learning, right? It's really about design, it's really about making things. You know, you sort of get in there and you get your hands dirty. And the thing that I'm sort of interested in for that is that when we talk about making in schools or making in education, we tend to focus on the thing that people are making, right? So we're like, oh, it's about, like, you know, the coding, or it's about the building, or it's about the whatever. And what we tend to underappreciate is that there's pedagogy around that experience, right? And so this is where it sort of ties into DC's work on motivation, that usually when people are making things, they have a lot more control over how they're going to make it. They have a lot more autonomy. They are typically doing something that they've chosen to do, so they choose something that has purpose for them. And then as educators, we provide sort of the scaffolding. We help them get better at it. And so those three things together allow people to be really motivated in what they do. And it's hard to do making. It's hard to do kind of physical projects without having those things. It's not impossible, right? It's like you can totally do things that are more constrained. But generally, when we talk about making in education, we are doing things that fosters kind of intrinsic motivation. However, you can foster that type of behavior by learning experiences that don't actually involve making things in the traditional sense, right? And there are, like, you know, you can learn math, you can, like, you know, read or do critique. There's lots of ways that you can incorporate those those ideas around motivation into learning that don't actually involve physical objects. And so I think that when people talk about making in education, I feel like they kind of fixate on the object and not on the sort of learning and motivation that goes around it and the sort of self-efficacy of, like, doing things with your hands and being confident that you can do them. And I think we sort of started at Olin with, oh, this is authentic engineering, you're going to do things with your hands. And I think over the years, because many of us are interested in education research, including myself, we sort of realized that, oh, actually, like, it's the pedagogy around projects and the pedagogy around making that is actually the valuable part, and how do we actually extend that across the curriculum and extend that more broadly through learning. And it is really sort of a different philosophical position about what the learner is doing, right? It's doing what your professor or your teacher tells you to do step by step versus you have a lot more sort of control and autonomy over what you do. And I often think of this as the Tetris versus Minecraft model, right? So, like, Tetris can be super motivating, right? It's like, I love playing Tetris. And because it's that sort of, you know, that heavily scaffolded sort of competency, like, you're getting better at it, right, step by step. And at the other end is Minecraft, which is very open-ended. You can do kind of amazing things, but it's much harder to get into, right? It's much harder to sort of learn what you're doing. And I feel like a lot of so that's sort of one way of thinking about education, that we are sort of, a lot of education is kind of on the Tetris side, which is, you know, doing worksheets or, you know, going step by step through things, which can be motivating. And I certainly was super motivated by that type of education when I was a teenager in engineering school. And we're sort of pushing it along the continuum a little bit more towards the Minecraft side, where people bring, you know, we basically provide scaffolded learning and we provide coaching, but people basically come to it with their own purpose and do what they're actually do, sort of working on larger projects that are not sort of controlled. It's kind of a coaching model. So coming back to sort of that making piece, right? It's thinking about, you know, the not just that making is bad, it's actually, so there's sort of two sides to it. Like, one is appreciating things that are not making, and the other is, what do we learn from making that we can actually take more broadly out into the world, or out specifically into education?
I mean, I'm kind of struck by already quite a lot of the things that you've said, and I I had no idea of the existence of Ursula Franklin before before recent weeks and before you kind of wrote some things or pointed me towards various pieces. And I started reading her book recently, and it seems that a lot of the kind of ideas that she was writing about are apparent in kind of what you're talking about now, particularly in this kind of context of technology and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah, for sure. Do you know, I mean, I don't know if you know the sort of backstory for this, but I read... So she gave the Massey Lectures in 1989, and I got a copy of the book probably very soon after, like 1990, 1991. So I was an undergraduate engineering student. And I read it, and it kind of sat on my shelf for a while. And then I'm not sure what prompted me to reread it a couple of years ago. And there was that kind of almost shocking moment of recognition where I realized that so much of what I do was rooted in that book, right? To the point, and so it's like I almost didn't remember what was in the book because I just kind of incorporated everything into how I think about many things.
Yep.
And education is a big one, thinking about education as development, thinking about sort of gardening versus factory model, a lot of stuff around sort of the prescriptive versus holistic technologies. And then, you know, the other thing, and this is less apparent in that book, and it's more apparent in interviews, about how seriously she took the work of, in her case, specifically women in engineering, which is also something that I spend a lot of time doing, but also it's like a thing where it's like, part of your job is to try to make this a better environment for women and other underrepresented groups, and it's just the work that you do. And she was a professor emerita in the same department where I did my PhD. She was actually the first female faculty member in the School of Engineering at the University of Toronto, which is where I was as both an undergraduate and for grad school. And then she was already emerita by the time I started in her department. But reading her talking about basically shaping the, you know, working to shape the environment, so two things that struck me were, one, I was a beneficiary of all the work that she did in that department, even though I didn't know her or work with her at the time. And second, that I had taken on, along with a number of my colleagues, I had taken on the same tasks here at Olin College and more broadly in the world, because I tend to do a lot of gender and STEM stuff outside of Olin as well. So yes. So, you know, incredibly deep influence on me and almost sort of went unnoticed until I reread the book and sort of recognized that it was there. And then the other thing, of course, is that rereading that book almost a quarter century later, certainly two decades later, was the applicability of the way she thought about things. Like, this was not a book that was out of date, right? There's only a handful of things in there that were sort of tied to the time. And some of the things she said were utterly prescient. Right. So one of the things that she said was, she talked about, as you may recall, she talked about sort of the military-industrial infrastructure and the long lead times, and said, you know, we're coming up to the end of the Cold War, and it's going to be necessary for there to be another sort of endless war in order to basically keep these chains of research and production happening. And so, you know, here we are 15 years into the War on Terror, and it was like, oh, that was the thing that the war.
Do you think she's under-recognized or under-appreciated? I mean, I hadn't heard of her, but that just could be because I'm ignorant.
No, I generally think she's under-recognized. I think she is widely known in Canada. I mean, the Massey Lectures that she gave were broadcast on CBC, which is the radio station. But so she was definitely sort of a public intellectual in Canada. She's certainly not very well-known outside of Canada. Very, very many people that I know that have discovered Ursula Franklin in the last couple of years. So it's nice actually basically seeing people outside Canada who weren't sort of exposed to her basically learn about her work and find that it's relevant and resonates with them still. And, you know, I think a chunk of it is she has a sort of essentially very deep humanist, compassionate viewpoint about technology and a belief in that it's not a belief in a collective society, not an atomized society. And that is just as relevant, if not more relevant, today than it was when she wrote the lectures and delivered them.
Could you say a little bit about your kind of work on the education process itself? I mean, I know, at least from what I've been able to read, that this seems like an important part of your work, both on the research and just in general working with students and trying to make it better for them. What have you kind of learned from this?
So one of the things that I think a lot about is public higher education and the sort of mental models that we use for how we think about education. So the general model that's been adopted is the sort of factory model of education, right? It's like, and so one is you have an input and you have a process and then you have an output. And the thing you're trying to do is for all of the, to have quality control on the output, right? All of your graduates can do X, Y, and Z, right? They are all these things. The other way in which it resembles the factory model of education is the sort of efficiency, right? How little money can we spend on it to get these outputs? And that's really particularly public higher education is really sort of where I see that. So I went to school in Canada. When I went to school, my tuition was low enough that I could work my way through school. And it is kind of astonishing how much it costs to go to university in the United States at any, like at public schools or private schools. And people are good at providing aid, but people, you know, still graduate with an insane amount of money and loans. The Obamas, I think, just paid off their student loans like maybe 10 years ago. I was like Bruce Sterling's characterization of this, that we take our best and our brightest and then we shackle them in chains of debt. I mean, they can't do anything interesting. And I have a friend who, you know, went to law school, she's a lawyer, and she was basically offered a free ride at the University of Washington, which is her sort of public state school, or she could have gone to Harvard and would have graduated with debt. And the reason why she wanted to become a lawyer was to work with refugees and immigrants and other sort of unmarginalized groups. Right. And she realized that if she went to Harvard and graduated with six figures of debt, she couldn't actually do what she wanted to go to law school for. So she turned down Harvard and she went to the University of Washington and is now practicing doing what she wanted to do. Right? Graduate without debt is practicing doing what she wanted to work on. That's a hard decision for lots of people to make. Right? Like, unless you're sort of super, she was super committed to, this is why I'm going to law school.
Yeah.
But, you know, very few people would necessarily be in a position to do that. And, you know, there is absolutely value in going to expensive schools. But the thing is, it's not even like, oh, you can go to your public school for free or you can pay to go to the Ivy League, right? Your public school is still extraordinarily expensive. So a chunk of this is a sort of public education, like what do we think education is for? How do we fund it, right? And you know, there's the sort of standard answer, which is that people who get educated contribute a lot more to their country, right? And they pay a lot more money in taxes, and it's a good investment. But of course, the real answer is not it's a good investment, right? It's not the monetary answer. It's the you allow people to like self-actualize, to create what they can create. You build in social mobility so that people have an equality of opportunity to go and work and create new things. So I'm at a tiny private school, right? It's like it costs a fair bit of money to come here. We have excellent scholarships. In fact, we used to be a full scholarship school before where we paid your entire tuition before the 2008 market crash. And now we pay half of students' tuition. So there's only about 350 students. There's less than 50 faculty. We keep hiring, so I think it's about 40 now. So tiny, tiny, tiny place. So one of the questions is, you know, so why do we exist, right? And there's a real argument to be made that you can either do the thing that we're doing, which is very sort of individualized education, very hands-on, access to equipment you wouldn't have otherwise, constructivist, right, creating yourself, very much about interacting with your peers, working in teams, working in collaborations, or you can kind of go to the sort of MOOC side, right, where you're like, you know, you're just online and you're sort of interacting with people online, which is very inexpensive, you know, very easy to deliver. There's not a lot of space in a world where people are putting pressure in how much money we spend on education. There's not a lot of space for the traditional model of education where 200 people sit in a room with a lecturer. And so one of the ways I sort of say it is, like, if you can be replaced with a video monitor and online quizzes, you will be, right? Like, I mean, you can put a video camera in any of our classrooms here, and you couldn't capture the experience of being there, right? Like, it would not be useful for someone else to watch that video in terms of learning things, right? Because all of the learning is happening by the students, between the students, right? Almost none of it is a sort of broadcast model of education. And so, you know, on the one hand, this is sort of a really sort of expensive artisanal proposition, right? It's like basically saying, you know, this is what learning is. On the other hand, the existing model of education doesn't really work all that well. Right? So it's not like, oh, we have this thing and it's super expensive and it's a sort of bespoke model of education. It's like, well, you know, MOOCs mostly only work for people who are already successful in traditional education, right? Many people, I mean, I'm so even just focusing on engineering school, right? Like, the fact that there is this enormous gender imbalance in engineering school, it's been 20% women for the last 10 or so years. It sort of went from like the early 70s to about 2000. It went from basically zero to about 20%, and it's been holding at 20% since then. If you have a gender imbalance, it's a sign that you are not providing a learning experience that works for everyone, right? And it's even more profound when you look at underrepresented groups, right? So in the U.S., I would be Native Americans, and then Latinos, and African Americans, right? Are deeply underrepresented in higher education in general, and engineering in particular. So, you know, the thing we're trying to replace is not like it works amazing, right? That, you know, we have a system that works for a very small fraction of people, right? Which is people who are like, in my case, in engineering school, people who are super motivated by, I'm going to sit in my room and like solve do problem sets. And one of the things we're sort of interested in is sort of broadening this idea of what education is. And the second piece of it is a lot of the skills that we're interested in developing in our students are the skills that historically have been developed kind of in an ancillary way. So it's like engineering schools typically don't teach you communication. They don't teach you teamwork, right? They don't teach you design, or at least historically they haven't really taught design. And you just kind of pick these things up, and then you went out in the workforce and you either had them or you didn't, or you developed them or you didn't. And so we're sort of taking these things that have always been kind of pushed to the side. So it's like, oh, we're going to teach engineering content, and then all of these things are happening on the side. And basically made them the center, right? So I teach material science, and I teach it in a project-based course, and my students write up what they did for their projects, and the sort of thing I tell them is, like, you're probably not going to grow up to be a material scientist, right? You're taking material science because it's an important underpinning for what any kind of engineering you do, actually having some appreciation for what's happening with materials. Like, if you're working in the physical world, right, having some appreciation for what those materials are is useful, but I know that when you graduate, you're going to be communicating your ideas. You're going to be, you know, making decisions about what you're going to do, dealing with it when things go wrong, all of those things. So I'm going to explicitly develop those skills in my course that's nominally material science, right? So there's that sort of chunk of it, bringing what's sort of been on the periphery into the center. Recognize that those are the skills that people are going to use when they graduate. And you know, specifically, you know, people always talk about, oh, it's a changing world, right? And it's like, so my father graduated with an electrical engineering degree a generation before I did, right? 20 years before I did. And so when my father went to engineering school, like, the entire solid-state transistor revolution had yet to happen, right? So, like, everything that he learned in electrical engineering, by the time I went to engineering school and started taking electrical engineering courses, right, like, the entire universe of electrical engineering had basically changed. And so we could always be like, oh, like, we have a full curriculum, we know what we're teaching people, but the reality is we know that in the next 20 years, and the next 20 years, and the next 20 years, i.e. within our students' careers, things are going to change. So teaching them a sort of specific set of, here are these things you can do, is really not the thing that makes the most sense. Teaching them a set of skills to, like, actually go out and, like, find information and synthesize it and figure out how they're going to do it and not be afraid of blank sheets of paper, those are the things that it makes sense for us to teach our engineering students. And engineering is kind of the context we do it in, right? But because you can't learn those skills in isolation, but it's not about sort of getting a set of content in their head. So that's kind of the other, you know, side of, like, what I've sort of learned from this is, right, is thinking about what higher education is for, right? What engineering education is for, what we're trying to develop in our students. And you know, this is not, so, you know, we can do it here. We work with other schools, you know, the, I remember working with a public school in fairly straitened circumstances, not in the U.S. And I, you know, I basically said, like, yeah, like, you're in a factory, right? And it's like, the thing we're going to do is we're going to start planting flowers in the corners of the factory and, like, you know, growing the garden. And it's so, you know, we're going to keep growing them, right? And at some point, hopefully we can make the decision that we're going to raise the factory or part of the factory or, you know, and have the garden instead. But, you know, we are all trying to do this in this larger context where higher education is seen as a means to an end, not sort of an end in itself.
I mean, it seems that then is heavily, heavily dependent on having teachers and a kind of community of educators who are all keyed into that. I mean, I'm just wondering whether the numbers of people are there to be able to offer that.
So I think it's actually more than you think. I mean, people become teachers because they like teaching, right? And there's a psychological shift from being like, I'm the person at the front of the room who has all the answers, to I'm the person who can help you find answers. Certainly in higher education, like, you get, you know, when you get a PhD, people think of a PhD as like, oh, I have this like content domain specific knowledge. But what a PhD actually is it means that you can work on a long-term research project over the course of, like, you know, 4 or 5 years. You can figure out what you need to learn and learn it, and then you can communicate it at the end. And it turns out that the ability to find and, like, to basically find, synthesize, and communicate knowledge is highly transferable, right, to coaching. And certainly in higher education, if you've done a PhD, you've been the recipient of that kind of learning, right? You know what it is. What we're not used to doing in higher education is using those types of learning modes with undergraduates rather than graduate students, right? But it's not like these are not alien learning modes, right? The people, in many cases, the people who stand up in front of their lecture and, like, just talk about stuff and are the same people who then go and have one-on-one meetings with their graduate students, right? So this is not an alien mode. The other thing is that it doesn't, it's not an all or nothing proposition. So it's not like, okay, well, you could only have, like, okay, well, you just meet with your students and you work with them, or you have lectures. A lot of it is, how do you actually bring some, like, if you start with these sort of set of principles, then the question is, well, how do you bring those things into whatever setting you happen to be in, whether that's like a large lecture hall or whether that's like individual one-on-one mentorship. So, and then the other piece of it is that it's really hard to go back. So, like, once you've been teaching students and they stop asking you, like, is this going to be on the exam, right? Once you get away from that sort of coercive, yeah, like, I'm going to tell you what to do and you do it mode, man, it is like, I can't imagine going back to, like, I'm going to tell you what to do and you just have to do it because I say so. Because it turns out it's actually, like, it's not very pleasant to be, so this is DC, Edward Deci's book, Why We Do What We Do, on motivation. So I talked a little bit about intrinsic motivation, where you kind of genuinely are interested in doing this, and there's a bunch of different forms of extrinsic motivation. And the thing about extrinsic motivation, doing something because you have to, is that it feels coercive. Right, that if, like, and even if it's something that, even if something that you think is, like, worth doing or you want to do, so you only do something because someone else is making you, it feels terrible. It also feels terrible to be the person making people do stuff, right? Like, it feels bad to be coerced, but it also feels bad to be the person doing the coercing. So people in general are, not everyone, especially not an engineer, right? But a lot of people are definitely like, I would rather teach this way, I just can't because of the environment that I'm in. And so what we are interested in doing is helping people get the tools to do what they can in the environment they're in. And then, of course, what I would like to see in the longer term, in the larger sense, is like changes to the environment, right? And how we think about education.
Yeah, I mean, in our kind of most recent podcast episode, I was talking with someone who set up an after-school program by a bunch of female shark scientists, mainly in Cape Cod, who were offering this kind of after-school program as a way of kind of fostering and mentoring the kind of next generation, because also there's a huge gender imbalance in that field and kind of the field of marine biology in general. And it was surprising to me how effective such a seemingly small intervention was. Just to kind of pick up on that thread then, what are the kind of those environmental changes in terms of reforms or course corrections to the kind of education system in North America that would offer the potential for the biggest change?
That's a really good question. So what are the things we can do? And then there's like, what are individuals doing? So I feel like a lot of what we do is the sort of organizational change piece, right? It's the a better world is possible, and then here are some steps for how you can get from here to there. And here's why. I mean, it's the same, you know, all the stuff I just said about motivation, that also applies to educators, right? It's like feeling like you have control over what you're doing, feeling like you're doing something that's worthwhile, and then feeling like you actually know how to do it, right? And so a chunk of it is like basically helping people feel supported in doing it. There's no kind of one size fits all that you should do this approach, right? So mostly what we're interested in doing is here are some principles and here are some reasons why you might want to do it, and then here's some we often use design techniques, right? So here's like some strategies for design that will help you actually think about some of the things that you can do in your environment. So, but then the things that people actually come up with are vastly different, right? There's no kind of like one thing. And so, you know, we will often say, you know, you can design something from the level of like a 15-minute exercise in class to, you know, creating entirely new institutions, right? So there's like a whole sort of scale in which you can do it on. So it's less about like what is the kind of the one intervention, and it's a little bit more about the, okay, if you start thinking about education using a model that's not the I have knowledge in my head and I'm pouring it into your head model, and you start sort of seeing why the all of those other things, like particularly in engineering school, right, there's such a mindset of we're going to teach them this content, right? Like if you decide on a syllabus, it's you write down the 20 topics you're going to cover, and then you like lecture to people, and moving away from model, like, okay, what do you want them to be able to do at the end of the course or the learning experience or when they graduate from the program? And then it's like, okay, what kinds of experiences do they need to develop those skills? So not just like get the knowledge, but actually develop those skills. And then the thing that kind of comes along with that is like, what kind of attitudes or beliefs are they going to hold, right, when they graduate about those things, so when they finish this experience? So it's the, so like, you know, if you're like, oh, what's the one change? And the change is thinking about, okay, how do I design sort of student-centered education, but then thinking about the, what do I want my students to actually be able to do when they finish this thing, whatever it is, and then designing to that rather than sort of making a list of content and using this default mode of education.
And I mean, I was just thinking as you were saying that maybe even there's an argument to be made for kind of phrasing the question, particularly on this kind of broader environmental level, as a question of kind of what are the barriers to those changes to be made, because often it's more being prevented from doing things rather than needing to come up with some great new ideas.
Yeah. So, I mean, I talk about the fear. So people are like, okay, well, I get evaluated on how good my research is, so I don't want to spend more time on teaching than I have to. And I certainly don't want to spend a lot of time rethinking how I teach, right? I just want to like show up all the stuff I used last year and like deliver it and then like go and do the research because that's what I'm actually going to be evaluated on. So certainly, like, there's the sort of grassroots people making individual change. Having institutional support is actually super useful and valuable, right? And how and why people sort of get this top-down support, so one thing is new institutions, which is what we were, right? We're like, this is why we exist, or new programs. So so UCL in London has their integrated IEP, integrated engineering program, which is basically a new program. I work Olin as a Olin College. We were doing work with the University of Texas at El Paso on a new program there called the Engineering Leadership Program. So you can just create a program de novo. The next sort of thing is what I tend to think of as sort of like the existential threat model of education, right? Or model of why you might want to change things. And it's like, well, if your institution is teaching it, as I said, you know, teaching in a way that you can be replaced with MOOCs and video monitors, it will be, right? So it's like, how do you change what you're doing in a way that actually provides a reason for people to show up? And, you know, a good example of that is by far, like, it's kind of amazing that your entire class of students are in one place at one time, right? It's like, and so them being there and all talking to me is like such a waste of the fact that, like, no, this is like, they should be working with each other, right? This is like the, oh, like, there's, you know, how do you take advantage of this geographic co-location for like 2 hours? And it's less true here at Olin because we're a residential school. It's much more true at commuter schools, right? Where it's like, no, like, the time where they actually have with each other is super valuable. So a chunk of it is basically recognizing that for a lot of institutions, it doesn't make sense as a physical institution unless you actually do a better job of leveraging what students get by being in one place at the same time. So there's that sort of existential threat, like, why you should change model. And then there's the, so there's, let's see, let me go back and think this through. There's the, we're doing something new, so we can build this in. There's the, things will go badly for us if we don't rethink how we do this model. And then there's just the, you know, doing better by our students. And I feel like in the UK, the switch from unfunded, from paying tuition to not paying tuition, right? That sort of the, you pay £9,000 of tuition and you may or may not get it back, really kind of changes the model of what education is, right? And from the point of view of educators and faculty, you can't in good faith say, I do research and I teach students pro bono, right? It's like, you know, I push back against the consumer model of education, but at the same time, it's true that you have a real responsibility to your students in a way that you may not have had before. So there's certainly a certain amount of, okay, how do you actually provide good learning experiences to your students? So those are kind of three sort of modes for top-down change, right? To get that sort of top-down, that kind of top-down support. But I think you really need both to see real change. So like the IEP is a good example. At UCL, new programs are a good example, right? That you have both the sort of top-down institutional level, like, we will support you as you do this, and then you provide support to individuals to do new things and create new things.
Are you optimistic that that will happen, or do you have a sense that just it's an inevitability, so everyone will kind of be dragged into that regardless?
I do not think it's inevitable at all. So it is hard. So one thing about being in the United States is that there are a lot of universities in the United States, a lot of colleges. It's huge. And, you know, it's everything from sort of, you know, the Harvards and the MITs and the Stanfords on one end to, like, Oral Roberts, like, the sort of weird, like, Christian fundamentalist, I'm going to call them hyper-specialized sort of colleges at the other side. And lots of things in between, right? There's this incredible diversity, you know, small liberal arts schools, big public institutions, and so forth. And so it's hard to imagine that if you're a mid-range school that does sort of traditional, like, lectures and exams, given how quickly tuition has been rising, given the rise of technology, it's hard to imagine that people will be able to justify spending that kind of money to go to the school, like, as a value proposition. And that's what I mean when I say it's an existential threat, right? It's like, if you keep doing things the way you're doing while the world is changing around you, it's not going to make sense for people to do this anymore. But just because, I mean, you know, Polaroid died, right? Like, companies, institutions fail to change all the time, even if they're facing existential threats, right? So from that point of view, it's like, well, I think this is the argument for why you do this. But, you know, it's in my really bad days, I can definitely see a world where, like, there is a stratum of education that's kind of like the Harvards and the sort of Swarthmores and other small liberal arts colleges, and that are basically very, you know, very hands-on, you know, sort of bespoke education, and then everyone else basically just gets MOOCs, right? Just gets online learning, right? It's cheap. It's like, whatever, like, you're not in that upper tier. We're not going to spend money on you, or you don't have money to spend on it yourself, and you get this, like, sort of crappy second-rate education. And to be fair, you know, online stuff is going to get better, right? But so maybe that isn't as dystopian, you know, as it seems. But it seems like it's a totally realistic way for higher education. You know, that's a sort of Cassandra. That's how higher education can easily show up, right? You have this tier of like bespoke education, and everyone else gets basically the lowest cost education, regardless of how good it is. So, you know, I as a child of immigrants who went through a public education system and got a phenomenal education for very little money, and live a life that I could not possibly have lived had my parents not emigrated to a place where that was the world we lived in, I have a really strong vested interest in, you know, a world where everyone, regardless of what their background, has access to high-quality, individualized education.
Education is clearly kind of very important to your work. What would you consider to be the other important questions that you're interested in exploring or being tackled? And also, as a kind of corollary to that, how do you know you're asking the right questions?
Well, I don't know if anyone knows they're asking the right questions. So a friend of mine, Rich Stevens, is a web cartoonist. And I always like his phrasing, which is that you should only work on things that you're interested in, that you like, because if you're any good at them, you're going to end up doing them a lot. So there are something to be said for that sort of like self-protection of, I'm only going to do things that I think are interesting, because if I want to do them for real. And fortunately, you know, as I said, I'm enormously privileged to be at an engineering school that really allows me to explore a very broad space in terms of what I'm interested in. So, I would say, you know, my first 6 or so years at the college, I was mostly involved in building the college, so deeply involved in sort of the practicalities of teaching courses and getting the programs accredited and all that sort of stuff. For the next 6 or so years, I was involved in primarily engineering education research. So I just wrapped up an NSF grant looking at students doing project courses, and I ran a summer program for undergraduate students to do research in this space the last few years. And so I'm actually in the process of thinking about what I want to do for the next sort of big sort of patch of time. I still only have thoughts, but I haven't sort of decided what it's going to be. One of the things that I find myself sort of obsessing about a lot recently is, so two sides of it. So infrastructure and collective action. And so it's easy to think of, so engineers historically, you know, have been like, oh, you're going to go build the thing, right? You haven't had any sort of larger context for it, and you also did it as an individual. But at the same time, you know, we have all this infrastructure, right, that exists in our world, which we are not really even aware of, right? Like, by definition, it's infrastructure, it's infra, right? We don't notice it. And so one of the things I'm starting to think about is we are not, and this is, I think, less true in Europe and the UK, but certainly is true in the US, to a lesser degree, fortunately, in Canada, that we're not really good at making collective action or collective decisions. So like one of the things I think about, so I live in Cambridge proper, so I live in the city, and I work out in the suburbs, so I work out here at Olin College. And most days that I work out here, I drive to work. I actually got my driver's license after I accepted this job, and bought a car with my first paycheck, basically. And I hate driving to work. Boston's a horrible place to commute. And the problem is, and you know, the amount of money, if I took all of the money I spend on a car, leaving aside the stress of actually driving to and from work and the time, right? If I just took the actual dollar amount of money that I spend on a car, and that was my contribution to public transit, we would have an amazing public transit system, right? If I could get, like, you know, 10,000 other people to do that.
Yep.
And the thing, of course, is that I have no way of getting 10,000 other people to, like, want to commute from Cambridge to Needham so that it would make sense to have a public transit service. And so I have a car, right? And now that I have a car, then it's a circular problem, right? It's like, there's no way to take public transit, so I bought a car, right? And that means that there's going to be no way to take public transit because everyone who would need to do it already has a car. So that's that type of, and you know, the reason why that's interesting and important, right, is because with anthropogenic climate change, we need to be better at acting collectively to change things, right? Like, one of the reasons why I don't want to drive is because of climate change. There's no way out of it. Right? And it's like, I could change everything I wanted to about my own life, and it still wouldn't move the needle. right? Because there's no way to act, because I haven't figured out how to act collectively. And we don't have a good way of doing it at sort of the policy level. So there's that. So one of the things I'm kind of interested in is infrastructure as the manifestation of collective action, of collective policy. Sometimes they work well, sometimes they work less well. But one of the reasons why I'm interested in that is because I feel like it's interesting to look at that to basically get some models about how to collectively act to deal with what's coming down the pike. Right, and we can't do that if we only see the atomized elements of technology and not the collective element of technology. Right, it's like iPhones are awesome, right? But that's like a thing that you have that you hold in your hand. Right, it's not a thing that is collective. How do we better understand sort of the collective pieces? So that's only one of the things I'm thinking about. So I'm not sure. You may or may not know this, but I'm Canadian. So I'm from Canada, and Canada has one of the more interesting responses to the refugee crisis of any developed country. So, of course, almost all of the response to the refugees is happening in non-Western, non-developed countries, right? So, the picture of the little boy in the waters at the water's edge, which many people saw, which broke many hearts, right? So, Canada has a system by which groups of people can come together to privately sponsor refugee families, as well as having sort of publicly sponsored refugees. So thousands and thousands of Canadians, tens of thousands of Canadians have gone together and sponsored thousands of refugee families because there was this mechanism to get you and 10 families together to get a relatively small amount of money together and then sponsor a family. And so there's that sort of, like, you know, the thing that's hard to do as an individual. There's thing that, you know, in the U.S. it's really not really happening at the policy level, right? But although it is in Canada, but there is a sort of mesoscale level of organization that allowed essentially, I'm trying to think what the numbers are, but many more refugees to come into Canada. Right. But also, so turn people's sort of empathy and wanting to do something, it actually gave them a mechanism by which to actually do something. And so that's, to me, that's a super interesting model. Of like where's the sort of mesoscale collective action? And I think about it in things like the electricity grid and solar power, right? It's like, okay, you know, I do not want to be responsible for my own infrastructure, right? I don't want to live off
your house out in
I mean, it's that kind of atomization, right? It's like, so how do we think about this? How do we get a resilient grid and how do we get a sustainable grid that isn't just as atomized, like, oh, I'm producing my own solar power? And I mean, I am acutely aware of the fact that I am part of the first generation of women in all of human history who doesn't actually have to spend most of my time dealing with matters of like water and, you know, water and labor and food and so forth. I really like it. It's like, I really like the fact that on a daily basis, I don't actually have to think about things like where my sewage goes. A chunk of it is figuring out how do we extend that, and so, you know, I don't want to have to think about infrastructure, right? It's like, I'm perfectly happy not to think about infrastructure. So how do we extend that more broadly, but then also how do we deal with it in the face of climate change, in the face of, you know, having resilient systems and so forth? So what's the sort of the right balance there? So that's some one of the things I'm spending a lot of time, I think, thinking about these days.
As a way of just kind of shifting to talking a little bit about how you do the work that you do. You started kind of Meta Foundry, your email newsletter, relatively recently. Did you start that, you know, do you write in order to think, or is that a case of writing in order to communicate, or how is that useful for you?
I was going to say, it's funny because I'm trying to think of when I started it. I think I started it 2 years
About
ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
So like relatively recently in the sense of my professional career, although it seems like it's been... in terms of like internet time. Yeah, I mean, I think mostly it's basically a way to think through things in public and to get sort of feedback on what I'm thinking about and also to share what I'm thinking about. And the realization, I guess, that, so one, you know, as I said, I'm privileged to be in an environment that supports me spending time and energy thinking about these larger issues. The other sort of piece of it is realizing that I have sort of an unusually broad technical background that I can sort of bring and bring things together in a way that people who have sort of, particularly in the academy, people with discipline-specific training don't necessarily have that weird breadth. Like, by academic standards, I'm, like, a total dilettante, right? Like, I do so many different things. It's actually kind of always weird when I'm, like, going up for my annual review or my promotion. It's like, okay, should you be doing fewer things, right? Is it okay to do this many things? But in a way, MetaFamily kind of leverages the power of having that weird breath in terms of actually turning it on lots of other things and drawing connections between them. So you know, that doesn't really lend itself. It doesn't really lend itself to slightly different papers. It doesn't really lend itself to sort of traditional academic routes. And I'm grateful that people seem to be interested in the kinds of things that I say, which is kind of nice. And that people actually want to read it. But mostly, I think it's a way of sort of drawing together ideas and connecting ideas. And sometimes it's just, I wrote about VR a couple of weeks ago, and sometimes it was just, and the making piece was just like this too, right? Where I see a thing and I'm just kind of like, I'm really unhappy about this thing. Let me articulate why I'm unhappy about it, because maybe it'll help other people sort of figure out what they think about it. It's sort of certainly one of the other motivators. Although often, I would say that's a minority. Often it's a, here's some cool stuff that I would like to share, right? And sometimes it's like, okay, this thing in the world is really annoying. Let me figure out why I think it's annoying.
And the public-facing thing is interesting because it allows you to connect with other people and to kind of have some feedback on those ideas? Or
yeah, so that's a chunk of it. And so a chunk of it is basically getting feedback from other people. And then of course, part of it is just people who are sort of interested in the types of things I say. So the making piece was actually a really interesting example for that, because hands down, the most common piece of feedback I got from that was, you articulated something that I've always thought and haven't figured out how to say. And so that actually, that's a really great sort of piece of feedback to have, right? That it's like where people have had this disquiet and now actually have a voice, have a way to articulate it. So that's, I think it's not so much like, oh, like my ideas are so awesome. It's sometimes I just have more time and space to think about them and articulate them, and it helps other people think better. It's certainly one of the reasons why I do it. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's the nature of being sort of anyone who's being an artist or being an intellectual who's putting stuff out in the world, right, is that it's hard not to be, like, self-aggrandizing. It's like, oh, I have these ideas. They're awesome. People are interested in my ideas. But at the same time, there's a chunk of it, right? It's like you have to have that sort of self-belief that the stuff that I do is interesting to other people. And part of that self-belief has just come from feedback, right? From people that I like and respect saying, your stuff is interesting, please do more of it. So I'm highly self-conscious of being, I think my ideas are awesome. But at the same time, people think they're valuable. And from that point of view, it's useful for me to write things up, and other people seem to think it's useful for them.
I mean, one thing I suddenly wanted to ask you about was your kind of Zibaldone, kind of commonplace book. I'm much more familiar with the idea of a commonplace book. Just wondering how you use that. How does that fit into your work? What are your kind of routine around? How does that fit into your process?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to my colleague Sarah Hendren, because we're teaching a course together this fall, and one of the things we would like our students to start learning is sort of setting up systems to go out and to find things, but then also to sort of record them and to be able to find them again. And to basically get into the sort of curiosity sort of seeking mode, but then at the same time having a system so that they can actually look at things again. So having said that, it's like, I don't feel like I have a particularly...
developed system.
Passive system. I mean, I mostly just use Pinboard and tagging to find things, and then I use citation managers, like reference managers, for sort of research papers and stuff. Pinboard is essentially a foxonomy, right? That you create your own tagging system, which actually, if you're just using it yourself, works, right? Because it's like I know what I'm looking for because I have a vague memory of what's in the directory, and I know how I think, so I know which tags I use. So it's sort of relatively easy to go back and find stuff. A chunk of that is, basically it's the seeking side, right? It's for me, a lot of that is sort of social, right? It's like following people and seeing what they share. And then a smaller chunk of it is going and sort of specifically kind of searching for things. You know, the other piece of it for me is, of course, I'm embedded in an academic institution, so I have really excellent library access, even at this little tiny college, right? That, interlibrary loan is sort of a big part of my life, right? That I can get access to scientific papers and books basically on demand. I belong to three different libraries. I belong to the university library, like to the college library. I belong to my local public library, and I actually belong to a 19th century private library called the Boston Athenaeum. I use it as a library, but I also just use it as a third space of the place where I work. And it's a very sort of arts and humanities oriented place versus the engineering school, and then of course the public library. So having access to. Having access to sort of papers through having access to a university system is definitely part of how I can find things.
But I mean, your book was a physical book, you're writing things by hand, or
so I sort of live in notebooks. The Zibaldone in particular. The commonplace books there tend to be a little bit more structured. The Zibaldone is just kind of it's just sort of incredible. Like he has all kinds of stuff jammed into it. So I have a small notebook that I tend to record small things in, but I also tend to put in, it seems like this year it's mostly media. So tickets, like ticket stubs for museums or movies or, I write down the books that I read and, with a few sentences. And in part, that's actually a bit of a reaction to so much of what I do being digital. Right, that it's like, oh, like here's a thing that is like some record of what I did this year, and I think of James Bridal, who described a book as a souvenir of having read it, right? And so keeping ticket stubs and making notes on books is a way of sort of physically instantiating these sort of cultural experiences, and then beyond that, I'm the kind of person who tends to use a notebook for each project, and then I have folders associated with it, and so I'm often going back and forth between writing in my notebook and then putting things in digital files is mostly how I sort of organize things. So, you know, right now I have a sort of a notebook that I just use for general, like everything I'm writing and thinking, which includes things like the newsletter, and then I have a notebook that's specifically for my big research project. I have a notebook that I'm wrapping up. I have a notebook that's specifically for teaching. I have a notebook that's specifically for like work, like sort of administrative committee work at the college, and then I have books that are associated with specific projects that I'm working on.
And are you then periodically kind of going through and essentially transferring the...
And they're normally kind of going back and forth to digital, right? So often it's like, I will just write here because I'm not near my laptop, or because I just want to like change the pace at which I'm thinking. And so almost everything that gets written down eventually gets turned into digital form at some point. Not everything. So the other thing is that I'm like such a strongly text-based person, right, that almost everything I write is words. And one of my goals for the next year or two is to train myself better to get better at sketching, to get more confident at sketching, and start using using nonverbal, so graphical, so not sketching like representational sketching, but basically using sort of nonverbal ideas. Because I've been sort of so heavily trained in the text tradition. And now I'm trying to do more work in both 2D and 3D sort of design and graphic, and to sort of open up my ability. So both how I think in both senses, right? So how I think by actually my process, but also how I think in terms of how I think about things, rather than just thinking about things in sentences, sort of think about things in a more sort of open-ended graphic way. So I'm planning on going into sabbatical next year. One of my professional development goals is to work more on this. And then over the last year or two, I started using Instagram in part to basically force me to take photographs and to see the world instead of writing about it, based on my friend Clive Thompson, who's a journalist, who at some point either wrote about or talked about using Instagram to basically to get you to look at the world more around you in sort of a visual way. I did a bunch of sort of design work as part of the Situated Systems Project in the first half of this year. So, you know, doing more sort of more design, and I've been doing more work, ironically, for someone who wrote that Maker piece, I've been doing some work in the sort of making in the humanities space, right, thinking about connecting design and critique, or design and sociology, or like work in the humanities space, not just design and engineering. And in fact, the course, I'm co-teaching a course this fall with Sarah Hendren, that will be in that space. That will be a combination of sort of reading and design work among the students.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly read various things on the about the this Situated Systems project. It sounded really, really interesting to have almost the physical artifacts alongside the other things that were going on.
That was, because it was out of Autodesk's digital fabrication facility, Pier 9, the idea there was very much to use fabrication techniques, digital and otherwise, as part of the research process, as well as part of the output. And this was, this had, I mean, so Ingrid Burrington and George and Sherry Wasserman in particular were two of my collaborators who were designers and artists. And it's a little bit more natural for them as part of the process. George Voss has spent a lot of time in that space. Georgina Voss has spent a lot of time in that space. Of the four of us, I think I was the person who had the least sort of design or art experience going into this. So so it was a learning curve, right? I mean, it was fantastic and it was totally worth doing. But it was definitely like really pushing myself in terms of other ways to sort of express or think about things, which of course is why, you know, why I wanted to do it. So both sort of learning about the topic that we're researching, which is military infrastructure in the Bay Area, but also really to start pushing and using this new set of techniques. And it's just the, you know, just the idea that the way you think about things is connected to what you think about. So
yeah, and it was, I mean, it was really interesting because you also documented more or less your kind of evolving thoughts and approaches to it in Meta Foundry. So you can almost kind of, there are various snapshots along the way. That's nice to have that as well.
Because now I need to go back and reread them. Because, of course, you know, I was just writing them. I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. And I haven't really sort of put them together into, like, oh, there's actually an arc of progress as we did things. So, but of course there would be, right? If I just took snapshots and you strung them together, it's like, oh, I'm sure there's an emerging narrative, but I don't know what it is.
I guess just as a kind of penultimate question, how are you reading so much? Every time I kind of look at your Twitter feed, there's always interesting things, new things. There's always new books that you're reading in Meta Foundry and so on. I also read a lot, but I know, do you have any secrets or?
No, in fact, I actually don't think I read very much at all. So it's funny because I feel like I'm bad at watching TV.
That's maybe so, the secret.
Yeah, I think that might actually be part of it. So I watch relatively little TV, and it's kind of embarrassing that mostly the TV I watch is I put like Netflix on something and like while I'm doing other tasks, but I'm bad at like sitting down and watching things. I'm really looking forward to watching Stranger Things because many of my friends have said it's fantastic. And so, but it does kind of require me to be seated in one place for a while, which I'm not actually all that good at. And so I think a chunk of it is, I mean, the answer to how I read so much is that Kindles and books are much more transportable than other forms of media. And so especially this year, I've been traveling a lot. So reading interstitially, like grabbing my Kindle and reading while waiting to board a plane is easy, right? Actually arranging to like watch other forms of media is hard. So I suspect that's part of the answer is that that text fits into my interstitial. Text fits into the interstices of my life better than other forms of media do. Because I have a lot of interstices, it tends to be what fills the gap. So I would think that's probably part of the answer. I'm trying to actually get better at reading long form. Like one of my things for the summer, like I feel like I'm really good at reading sort of short online essays, or even things that are described as long form, but less good at actually reading books. So I'm trying to sort of be better at sort of setting aside time to actually read books. In the last few months, because I wasn't doing it very much in the first half of the year.
What does it mean to be good at reading a book?
Like to actually not
finish it,
but to like actually like read a book for an hour, right? To be like, okay, the thing I'm doing for the next hour or two is sitting on the couch reading a book. And partly it's because I remember as a kid, I just like read I mean, was it Dylan Thomas who said that my education was the liberty I had as a child to read all the time with my eyes hanging out? And, you know, you're a kid and you don't have any responsibilities. And I had a library card. And it was just like, I just read constantly. So, and, you know, I was definitely the kind of kid who would read in class, right? Like, I'd have the book under my desk while, like, whoever was teaching stuff was talking about whatever they're doing. And I was, you know, I was a good enough student that, you know, when they asked questions, I could still answer it. So generally, you know, my teachers were okay with me reading because I was clearly not falling behind. So I definitely, and I guess so that to me, I guess that's the comparator, is like remembering what I would do nothing but read. So like all the reading I do seems like, oh, it's a small amount of reading. The other thing is that it's definitely cyclic, right? Because I'm on the academic schedule where I do different things from September to May than I do between May and August. So if you're looking at what I've been doing for the last few months, it may not be representative.
On the podcast, kind of guests at the end kind of come up with some picks. I wonder if you'd had a chance to think of a book that maybe our audience members might do well to give a read.
Okay. I think you said like a book,
a film, and a song.
All right. Okay. I'm just finishing Sarah Perry's novel, The Essex Serpent, which is, it's out in the UK. I don't think it's out in the US yet. But it's set in Victorian times. And it follows a recently widowed, woman which she moves from London to Essex and learns about a sea serpent, the Essex serpent, and its sort of role. And so it's nominally this book about, and the other main character is the pastor. And so it's nominally a book about this Victorian widow and her relationship with this pastor, but many of the concerns, many of the things that are in it are clearly contemporary. So one of the things is housing in London and the, you know, the deserving versus the undeserving poor, which is about as contemporary, I think, as you can get. So I'm not quite finished it. So, but unless something catastrophic happens in the next 20 or so pages, I think I really liked it. So that's the book I'm sort of currently reading. For film, I think I was talking to my friend yesterday about the movie Predestination, which I feel like is an underappreciated movie. Do you know it? Have you seen it?
This is from like 5 or 6 years ago.
Maybe not that long, but a few years ago. Yeah. Although it's possible that it was longer. I think I saw it on a plane. So I think I entirely missed it in theaters. It's based on a Robert Heinlein short story, All You Zombies. And it's a time travel story. And, you know, I definitely read science fiction when I was a kid. And I really like the phrase, the golden age of science fiction is 12. And I'm a little kind of resentful at all of the sort of 1950s and 1960s incredibly racist, incredibly sexist science fiction that I read as like a little brown Canadian girl. But that's, you know, that's what I was reading when I was a teenager, or like a, you know, tween a teenager. So it's not what I would consider to be promising source material. But the movie is phenomenal, and in part it's phenomenal because of Sarah Snook's acting in that movie, and part because of the sort of world that they created around her, where You know, it's set in the 60s or 70s, and it's a terrible environment to be a super smart woman, which she is. So it's just this, so that, and that really sort of comes across. And as I said, her acting is phenomenal. The role that she plays in that is phenomenal. So that's sort of an underappreciated movie that I really liked. And then song. So William Gibson tweeted something about, I think he said something like, is there a noir dystopian feminist romp? And which I suspect is this new novel, which would be awesome, because how can you not love a noir dystopic feminist romp? And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, well, so I feel like I'm sort of developing a bit of a sort of a canon, which currently consists of Mad Max Fury Road, the Beyoncé's Lemonade, the videos, And the Grimes, the video for Grimes' song Kill vs. Mame, which I would definitely describe as a noir dystopian feminist romp. So that might be my, it's also an amazing, amazing song. Like it's the, so that might actually be the song that I recommend to people.
Excellent. Thank you very much. How can people stay in touch with your work, keep up with what you're doing? Where can they find you online?
So the easiest way to find me online is on Twitter. So I'm at Debcha, D-E-B-C-H-A. My newsletter is at tinyletter.com/metafoundry, M-E-T-A, foundry, like where you pour iron. And there's a full archive of the newsletter there.
For our listeners, if you heard a reference to something, a book, or a website, or an article, the full show notes with links to everything we talked about in the show can be found at sourcesandmethods.com. If you enjoyed what you heard this week and in previous episodes, please write a review of the show in iTunes or on Twitter or somewhere and tell someone in your own life. Thanks for listening.